Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Gender Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Isabel Machado and I'll be your host for this episode. Today I'm talking to Dr. Mia Fisher about her book, Terrorizing Gender, Transgender Visibility, and the Surveillance Practices of the U.S. Security State. It was published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2019. Terrorizing Gender traces how media and state actors collude in the violent disciplining of trans women, exposing the traps of visibility by illustrating that dominant representations of trans people as deceptive, deviant, and threatening are integral to justifying, normalizing, and reinforcing the state-sanctioned violence that's enacted against them. Dr. Mia Fisher is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Colorado, Denver. Her research and teaching focuses on LGBTQ media representations and the ongoing struggles of LGBTQ communities to access civil rights. Her work has been published in several academic journals, including Feminist Media Studies, Communication, Culture and Critique, Sexualities, and Communication and Sport. She also co-leads the Denver Pen Pal Collaborative, or DPPC. It's a collaborative prison pen pal project. Mia Fisher, welcome to New Books in Gender Studies.
Thank you so much for having me, Isabel. It's a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. I'm very glad that you are to have you here today. So much has happened since you accepted my invitation to come and talk to us, right? From appalling new cases of violence against trans women of color and men, to amazing protests, to historic legislation being passed, and we even have a new documentary on Netflix, right, about trans representation. I'd love to hear your take on it in a minute. Your book helped me understand and contextualize all of this a bit more deeply, so I thank you for that, and I hope that this interview will do the same to our listeners. But before we talk about the book, could you tell us a bit about yourself and how did this book come about?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you know, many academics, we all go to school for a very long time. And I started my doctoral program at the University of Minnesota in 2011. And so I'm originally from Germany. I had been to several other places in the U.S. Before I ended up in Minneapolis in 2011 for the PhD. But this is where I really started, focusing my research and my work on looking at issues of media representation, particularly of marginalized communities. So whether it was folks of color, whether it was LGBTQ communities. And as I got to Minneapolis, when we talk about sort of 2012, 2014, what I noticed was that all of a sudden, there really seemed to be a very tremendous increase of discussion and visibility of transgender people in mainstream media. And so I really just kind of started becoming more and more interested in what those representations of trans people looked like. And I also noticed simultaneously, though, that representation in the media didn't necessarily also mean improved living conditions and everyday lives for those trans communities. And so a very local event that just happened a few months before I got to Minneapolis was the attack on C.C. McDonald, which is one of the case studies in the book, which I'm happy to talk about later a bit more in detail. But there was a lot of activism around C.C. McDonald, who was a Black trans woman who was viciously the subject of a transphobic and racist attack. And so what was happening sort of locally on the ground very much also informed my interest in really looking at media representations of trans people and how that also reflected their everyday lives and experiences.
So let's begin our talk about the book by talking about the title.
Yes.
Can you explain what you mean by terrorizing gender?
Yes. I have to give a good colleague and partner of mine a shout out for coming up with this title. So terrorizing gender was really, or is the idea that what I'm trying to articulate in the book is that for trans, gender nonconforming, and non-binary communities, it is often not possible for them to just freely express their gender identity and the way that they self-identify and want to self-determine their gender expressions. And so terrorizing gender really refers to the fact that various state actors, but also media organizations, will literally and physically terrorize someone whose gender identity does not conform to sort of dominant norms and expectations. And so this is where the terrorizing aspect comes in. And as I illustrate in the book, this terrorizing can take really many forms with my case studies, whether it is just a news article that might use deliberately the wrong pronouns to refer to someone, whether it is, you know, the state throwing you in a jail based on your birth assigned sex. And so the terrorizing aspect really refers to the fact that we're still in a place where not everyone really gets to live their gender identity freely and openly.
I understand. As you were mentioning a minute ago, the year 2014 is perceived as some sort of a turning point, mm-hmm. or as that iconic Time magazine cover described it, the tipping point for transgender visibility. Could you set here the stage and remind folks what was going on at that time?
Yes, absolutely. It seems such, you know, 5-6 years ago, and it seems so long ago, but I think what we were sort of experiencing in this moment about 2014 till about 2016, the sort of second term of the Obama administration, was really a very kind of optimistic sense that somehow trans people were really at the brink of becoming fully integrated and accepted into our national imaginary. And so on the one hand, this was reflected in the increase in media visibility and presence of trans people. So let's take, for example, shows like Orange is the New Black, who start appearing around that time with Laverne Cox in a very prominent key protagonist role. There was also the famous transition and coming out of Caitlyn Jenner, I think, is another example of some of this trans visibility. And then you just mentioned the iconic Time magazine cover with Laverne Cox, the first trans woman of color to be headlining a Time magazine issue. And this ominous transgender tipping point really seemed to insinuate that somehow really we now were fully accepting and integrating trans people, that they were increasingly gaining access to civil rights. The Obama administration, for example, had repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the infamous military ban. Obama had extended protections for trans people under the Affordable Care Act. So there was also the sense of legal progressivism that was including trans people for the very first time. So it was a very different sort of cultural moment than what we're obviously in right now, with a lot of the backlash we could argue trans people are currently facing.
Yes, you're right. This seems like ages ago.
I know.
But as you were saying, you argue that this tipping point leads to a conservative backlash with increased surveillance mm-hmm. and regulation of trans people by the security state and media organizations. Can you provide some examples of that backlash?
Yes. So even when we're, you know, looking at 2014 or 2016, when we look at, for example, the numbers of whether it is, say, housing or employment, that trans people even then were dealing with disproportionate lack thereof. So high unemployment rates, lots of, you know, homeless folks who or among the LGBTQ community, and especially also the number of murders of trans people, particularly trans women of color, was also increasing during the 2014 to 2016 time period. And then arguably, especially with the election of the Trump administration, we could really see a sort of full-on force conservative backlash that is now also really explicitly trying to roll back some of the legal protections that trans people had won under the Obama administration. So I think some of the most prominent examples of this backlash are probably the discussion around Trump's ban on trans military service members. As you might remember, this has been going through various sort of court proceedings, and ultimately the Supreme Court ruled that it is legal for Trump to ban trans people from military service. I assume a lot of you have probably also heard about the debates around bathroom bills and bathroom legislation, so that trans people are not allowed to use public restrooms that actually are confirming or in alignment with their gender identity. We have huge discussions right now about trans people in sports. There is a bit of a panic, we could call it, that somehow trans women are threatening cis women in sports. So I think those are just some of the most prominent examples in the ways in which this backlash has, I think, increasingly also permeated our national debate and discussion.
Mm-hmm. And an important concept that you use here throughout the book is visibility politics. Mm-hmm. Could you explain and define it for us?
Yes, absolutely. So visibility politics dates back, we could say, probably till about the 1950s and 1960s, and has long been a strategy for marginalized groups to, I guess, you know, claim their place in larger national discourse. So for LGBTQ communities specifically, many national organizations such as the Human Rights Campaign or GLAAD for a long time have basically argued that we need to make LGBTQ folks more visible in the mainstream, in news media, in fictional media, because they argue visibility in the media can then also lead to improved living conditions, access to legal rights, et cetera, for those marginalized communities. And so what I argue and many other media scholars argue is that this focus on visibility and media representation surely is important because we all know it is important to have diverse representation in the media, but that visibility alone does not necessarily really also lead to improved social conditions for various groups. And what also often complicates visibility is that when we look, for example, let's say shows like Modern Family for LGBTQ representation, is that that visibility is often a very narrow and privileged one. So Modern Family, we had the kind of very ideal couple, husband team who really desired to be married, who wanted to have children, and who are also very middle to upper class, and they're white. So a lot of media scholars argue that visibility politics often sort of narrowly focuses on a certain kind of visibility that becomes acceptable and respectable, but that also often leaves out those LGBTQ folks that might not be able to conform to some of these narrow ideals. And so as I argue in the book, is that especially for trans people, the sort of desire to become visible in the media often actually leads or becomes sort of a double-edged sword. Because as I point out in the book, this visibility can sometimes also actually result in more harm, more surveillance, and more repression by various state or media organizations.
Now I wanted us to talk about your case studies. Mm-hmm. The book, Terrorizing Gender, focuses on three case studies. And as we talked before, off the record through email, in light of current events, I would love for us to focus more specifically on C.C. McDonald's mm-hmm. case and have this broader conversation about violence against Black trans people.
Yeah.
But before we do that, could you briefly introduce the two other cases so that folks know what we're talking about?
Yes. Yeah. So, Isabel, as you point out, the book is structured around three case studies. The first case study is about Chelsea Manning, which is for probably or often, I think, sort of the most maybe prominent figure that folks recognize as being trans. And so Chelsea Manning, for those of you who might not remember, is a former U.S. Army intelligence analyst who worked in Iraq for the U.S. Army. And in 2011, basically passed along a giant trove of classified and unclassified documents to the organization WikiLeaks. And those documents depicted sort of widespread wrongdoing by U.S. forces in Iraq. So documenting anything of U.S. forces killing Iraqi civilians from kind of meddling in Iraqi elections. So it really didn't make a U.S. foreign policy and the U.S. military look very good. And so Manning passed these documents onto WikiLeaks, who published them and, of course, generated a huge outcry and debate. And so Manning was arrested shortly after those documents were leaked and was then held in military confinement. And so the story really has so many angles to it. But what seemed to really kind of explode everything on an even bigger level was when Manning announced that she identifies as trans and wanted to transition while she was awaiting her trial. And so what I noticed was that once she announced that she identifies as trans, that media coverage really took on a very demeaning, derogatory term in terms of basically arguing that because she is trans, she is mentally unstable, and that's why she leaked all those documents. And not because maybe she had a larger conscience about, you know, wrongdoing of our military and of U.S. foreign policy. So that is the Chelsea Manning story, which I really trace from 2011 till 2019. There's so many complex angles to the story. But what really struck me was basically how media coverage really fed into this narrative that somehow her identity as trans made her a threat to national security, that she aided the enemy. And it wasn't really a discussion about sort of the ethics of her decision. And as I point out, too, there were really very questionable ways in which she was treated while she was confined. There was an incredibly long period of pretrial detention, which some would argue is unconstitutional. She was put in solitary confinement for numerous months on end, which really also took a toll on her mental health. And so it is really an analysis of looking how media coverage and the military's treatment of her kind of came together to create this narrative of Manning being an enemy of the state. So that is just in a very sort of brief nutshell, the Manning case study.
Yes.
It is, you know, a lot to condense.
Yes.
Maybe another last point I would add about Manning is, too, that in a second chapter on Manning, I specifically look sort of how LGBTQ organizations reacted and responded to her actions. And what was really interesting was that she was really very much shunned by mainstream LGBT organizations like the HRC. They really didn't want to sort of become involved in this case. The reasoning, I think, was that at this same time period, 2016, a lot of these organizations are lobbying for the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. And of course, Manning's story sort of didn't necessarily help that cause. And so I also kind of really try to point out in the book again how certain trans people are not also often really following the larger narratives that some of the mainstream LGBTQ organizations want to create in terms of, again, expanding rights for LGBTQ citizens.
Yeah, that those two chapters really helped me understand Manning's case. As you mentioned, okay. It was the one I was more familiar with of the mm-hmm. three. But
I'm glad I was able to do that. And it's also, I don't know if, you know, some of you might have more recently heard that Manning, again, she was President Obama commuted her sentence at the end of his term. So she was actually released in 2016. But then she was incarcerated again more recently because she has refused to testify in a grand jury case against Julian Assange. And so her sort of ongoing targeting by the U.S. state, I think, is really it's horrifying. And it's really a tremendous case in terms of really, again, looking at how the U.S. state treats certain subjects that are not necessarily conforming to dominant ideals and norms.
Yeah. But before we talk about C.C. McDonald's case, can you introduce mm-hmm. the third case?
Yeah, the third case study in the book is looking at Monica Jones, who is also a Black trans woman from Phoenix, Arizona, and is also, at the time, she was a student at ASU working in a social studies program. And Monica Jones, what happened to her was really interesting and also, again, terrifying in many ways. She was a very outspoken sex work activist. And so when several years ago, 2014, in Arizona, she was basically walking down a street, waiting at a bus stop, an undercover cop pulled up and invited her to get into the car and said he would take her over to the bar. And so she accepted. And as he turns out to be an undercover cop, she basically got charged with a manifesting prostitution clause in Phoenix. And so because Jones's connections to previous sex workers' rights activism, the story really caught a lot of attention in Phoenix and in Arizona. It was also picked up by some trans civil rights organizations, because Jones really exemplifies what folks call walking while trans. So just because you're a trans woman of color, you might be walking to a bus stop, you might be wearing a dress, oftentimes gets them picked up by law enforcement, who then charge them with some dubious loitering charges, trespassing charges, etc. So that is one part of the Monica Jones story. But what then even really got more sort of crazy was when a year later, she tried to go back to Sydney, Australia, where she was doing an internship for her social work studies on an Australian sex workers organization. And so when she flew back to Sydney to complete that internship and complete her research, she was held up at the Sydney airport by immigration officials who claimed that she had violated her student visa. And as Jones is, you know, dealing with the immigration officials, all of a sudden a TV crew from the reality TV show Border Security shows up and is asking whether they could film this whole interaction. And I don't know if some of you might be familiar with Border Security. It has various other country outlets. There was one in the U.S. that didn't survive very long. But it's basically a reality TV show that looks at how tourists, travelers engage with immigration officials at various border settings. And of course, most of the episodes deal with people who have, you know, done something wrong, who don't have the proper papers or look, quote unquote, suspicious. And so Jones gets into this whole interaction with immigration officials, with the TV crew, and it becomes very clear that the TV crew was already previously tipped off by these immigration officials who are really looking to sort of profit on a quote-unquote juicy story about a trans woman of color who's, you know, has previous sex work charges. And so I really use this chapter to really kind of bring together how both media organizations and state actors really come together to further criminalize trans people, especially also in moments of border crossing, that really creates a networked sort of security apparatus that extends well beyond domestic borders.
Yes. Yeah, that story is really fascinating. And it has so many twists and interesting details that.
Yeah. It really does.
Yes. But for anybody who's listening to this who might not be familiar with the case, can you tell us who is Cece McDonald and what happened to her?
Yes. So Cece McDonald is a Black trans woman who was originally from Chicago, but also ended up in Minneapolis in the early 2010s. And Cece McDonald basically walked down a street in her neighborhood on a late summer night with several of her friends. And they passed a sort of working class white biker bar called the Schooner Tavern. And as they were passing this bar, a bunch of white patrons who were sort of hanging out in front of the bar, smoking, drinking, started harassing them, started, you know, calling them with various derogatory names, whether it was the F word, the N word, you name it. And so they got into this altercation with these bar patrons. There were glass tumblers being thrown. People were, you know, pulling hairs and stuff, etc. And at some point, one of the patrons, Dean Schmitz, was basically trying to follow Cece McDonald and, you know, trying to keep punching her. And so she had a pair of fabric scissors in her purse. And basically in this altercation, in the shuffle, Dean Schmitz got stabbed with these fabric scissors. And he ultimately died. And so the story really gained a lot of traction and attention because Cece McDonald was ultimately charged by the Minneapolis prosecutor with a second-degree murder charge. And so she was arrested, she was sent to jail, and she was being prosecuted for what activists and supporters of Cece argued was really a matter of self-defense, of really trying to defend her life against this very enraged white patron. And so that was the story. This is, as I mentioned, really just a few months sort of before I came to Minneapolis and really very much kind of influenced the whole trajectory of my work in the book in terms of me becoming really interested in how the local news media in Minneapolis was covering this case and also how the state really treated her in terms of, you know, thinking that why, you know, we're not going to grant her a right to self-defense. And so it was really revealing a lot of the intricacies of how generally Black people are treated in the criminal justice system, but then also specifically how trans women of color are facing intersecting oppressions.
Yes. What do you think this particular case can teach us about the discourses about and the violence against mm-hmm. trans people of color and specifically Black trans women?
Yeah, that's really a great question that I've been thinking about a lot, too, especially in light of, the developments over the last 2 to 3 weeks. When I, dove deep into Cece McDonald's case by looking at news media coverage, also looking at the court transcripts and the court documents, what really struck me was that on the one hand, we had, local news outlets, whether it was the newspapers or the channels, that really fed into so many tropes and stereotypes of Black people as being inherently violent, of Black people not deserving empathy or victim status, of Black people being inherently angry. And so I really noticed how a lot of these historical stereotypes recircled in Cece's case. And are recircling in so many other cases, right, that we see right now that somehow render Black people as not deserving of humanity and of living their lives. And simultaneously, when I looked at the court documents and the transcripts, what I noticed from the state and the prosecution was also this sort of notion that somehow the legal system is colorblind. It's allegedly colorblind, where we don't see race and we don't see gender, we don't see ethnicity. But it became so clear in McDonald's case that ultimately this sort of mantra of colorblindness is just used to really cloak the inherent systemic racism that is so fundamental to our criminal justice system. For example, Dean Schmitz, the guy that CC killed, had a giant swastika tattoo printed on his chest. But that swastika tattoo was not admissible in court, as the judge claimed, because it's not, quote unquote, proven that the swastika tattoo really means that he was a white supremacist. So there are all these, you know, intricacies in the law that ultimately end up really protecting white people, while at the same time, they don't protect people of color. They don't grant people of color the same rights that we often grant white people. And so for me, this case, again, this was back 2011, 2012. Sadly, I think just really is, you know, one of many cases where we see similarities reoccurring over and over again. When Cece was sentenced to 2 years in prison after she took a plea deal, she was, for example, in the beginning also put in a men's prison rather than a women's prison. She had to continuously fight for her right to receive health care during her incarceration. So her case also really speaks a lot to questions of the prison industrial complex, the fact that, again, our criminal justice system disproportionately convicts Black and brown people who also receive higher sentencing rates than white people. And so I think in many ways, really, her case really exemplifies a lot of the issues that we have been brought back to the forefront just over the last few weeks.
Exactly. So, yeah, as we speak, as we record this thing, the whole country and many other parts of the world as well are rising up, right, against systemic racism,
right,
and the police violence against Black people. How is this, or is it, affecting Black trans lives? Do you think they're being included in this conversation? Mm-hmm. There was a big demonstration in New York, but in general, what do you think?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. I talk about this, or I sort of, you know, dissect some of this too in the chapter on Cece that specifically sort of looks at the activism that started to happen around her case. And what I noticed too is that even, you know, at Cece's time back in 2012, when Black Lives Matter was also really gaining a lot of ground and being in the mainstream media, propelled by obviously, you know, the killings of Trayvon Martin, of Michael Brown, of Tamir Rice. What I also noticed is that oftentimes Black Lives Matter really meant Black men matter, right? And of course, that is because the media disproportionately sort of pays attention to the killings of Black men by police officers. But we don't often actually pay attention to the fact that there are as many Black women and Black trans women that are also the victims of state-sanctioned violence. And so what I am, I think, hopeful of is that the sort of recent resurgence and attention to Black Lives Matter does pay more attention to the fact that there are also trans women, women, brown Latinx folks that are also being targeted by this violence. And so I do think that compared to 2012, I think the current moment is, to me at least, seems to be paying more attention to some of the intersectional identities that are being targeted by state agents and state violence. You mentioned this rally in Brooklyn. I thought that was really, I just saw some news media coverage of it a few days ago too. And I was really like impressed and proud to see so many folks turning out for Black trans lives, because again, oftentimes Black trans women are sort of falling through the cracks when it comes to these larger movements. And so I do think it is refreshing to see that there now is more attention. And I do think that hopefully with the momentum that we've seen over the last 2 weeks, that we might actually really be at a point where we are creating more systemic change rather than just talking about police reforms.
Exactly. So I would like to shift gears a little bit and ask you about process, right? And you talk here about this process of questioning your positionality and your privilege. Mm-hmm. Would you mind talking about that?
No, absolutely. Yes, just one comment.
I was particularly interested in your discussion, and I'm going to quote you here about the blurred line between scholarship and activism, as well as the complex politics of allyship.
Yeah, I talk about both of those in it's in the introduction of the book, and I kind of return to it a little bit in the conclusion. And what I really had to grapple with, and I continue to grapple with in my ongoing work, is that I think we need to be, as scholars and researchers, really careful about the ways in which we write about communities that we are not a part of. So as you know, you can tell, two of the case studies in my book are about Black trans women. And it often my book talks about trans communities of colors more broadly. And obviously that is not a community that I am myself a part of. And so it really forced me to be very critical, self-critical and self-reflective about my process and about, you know, also just checking my own privileges as a white academic who identifies as queer, but who has, you know, undoubtedly much more sort of power than many of my informants that are part of my book. And so for me, that really has meant to actually read a lot of literature on feminist methodologies that I found really helpful in navigating some of these tensions and boundaries. It has also really forced me to think about the ways in which, you know, the fact that I have published a book on the subject matter that has undoubtedly helped me to get like a tenure track position, right? That has secured, but given me a secure income, while someone like Cece McDonald, for example, still struggles very much for her basic everyday survival, that I need to reckon with those power differentials and those hierarchies. And so for me, what has been really important is to think about the ways in which I'm accountable to someone like Cece. To me, that means, for example, actually paying people for their work, right? So if you interview someone, pay them for their time. I've also tried several times, and I continue to be inviting trans folks to come to campus for talks and screenings, for co-collaborations on articles. And so I think there are just ways in which we as researchers can really be more accountable to the folks who are often really providing us with the stories and a wealth of information that we otherwise would not have. And I think those are just some of the, you know, the small things that I feel at least everyone should do in terms of really trying to do their work ethically. And it also, of course, means that we're all going to mess up at one point or the other. And I think, again, just also acknowledging that we're not perfect, we're going to make mistakes, but how can we be really ethical and accountable to the folks that we write about, I think is really important. And as I mentioned, it's for me also still an ongoing process that I'm trying to figure out and navigate as I do this work.
I see. One, I found it really interesting is the concept that you bring by the mostly at the end of the book. Mm-hmm. Could you explain the concept, the idea of nobodiness, and how could it be used as a tool of resistance?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you're bringing this up. So the concept of nobodiness is actually something that Tourmaline, who's a Black trans woman, a filmmaker, and also really prominent activist, started using and articulating in a commencement speech that she gave at Hampshire College a few years ago. And I was really struck by her definition theorizing of nobodiness. So Tourmaline talks about nobodiness as basically being a sort of tactical, strategic navigation of spaces of visibility, invisibility, and hypervisibility. And this concept is very much informed by her own experience as an activist and as a filmmaker who has recently gained some prominence and fame, but whose work has also been very much exploited and abused without her really receiving credit for all the amazing things that she has done, for example, in terms of documenting and archiving the life of Marsha P. Johnson, who is one of a revered trans elder who really was fundamental in the 1960s and 70s to fight for trans rights and acceptance. And so Tourmaline really, I think, exemplifies or tries to articulate that we are, none of us are sort of in a space of impure politics. None of us are perfect. Sometimes we need to be visible to make our demands heard. We can think about the current Black Lives Matter protests, right, which are very much visible and in people's face. But as we know, again, sometimes that visibility also brings more harm to us. And so sometimes we also need to be invisible. We kind of need to be, you know, behind the stage working undercover to actually accomplish things. And so she talks about this nobodiness as the space of tactical navigation, where we kind of subvert dominant systems of oppression. And so I think some maybe good examples of this abstract concepts we can think about right now is, at least in my city here in Denver, I've seen really such great mutual aid work popping up since the pandemic, but then also really spurred by these latest protests, where everyday folks, neighbors come together to form groups to provide free meals to school kids, whether you're providing rides to your elderly neighbor to the grocery store, or you're forming, you know, a chain around a house of someone who might be subject to ICE deportation. So to me, nobodiness really infuses an understanding of mutual aid work that is happening all across the country right now that is not tied to big civil rights organizations or, you know, a central leadership figure, but it's sort of the small actions, everyday actions that all of us can take to really undermine, to challenge, and to resist a lot of the state violence that we currently see.
Well, yes, that was a particular section that I enjoyed reading because, you know, we all need some sort of like message of hope or I don't know. So that was helpful in my current state. I have recommended this book to a few folks already, and I would certainly recommend it to our listeners. But I would like to conclude, these interviews with a few questions, if it's okay with you, about books and projects, right? Mm-hmm. This is a podcast for and by folks who like or write or, you know, work in books. Was there any particular book that informed or inspired Terrorizing Gender?
Oh, that is a great question. I would say there was a whole bookshelf full of books that have certainly really influenced my thinking and my writing as I approached this work. I would say, you know, I was trained in media and communication studies, and I also have a minor in women and gender studies. But I really, for example, didn't know a whole lot about legal studies and critical legal studies. So I really had to read up on a whole lot of stuff. And so I would say the work of folks like Kimberly Crenshaw, Michelle Alexander has really been influential in terms of helping me understand how our legal system actually works. And again, with a particular eye towards the protection of whiteness in the law and how it is inscribed in the law. On the other hand, for the sort of activist thinking that I think is also very much inscribed in this book, I was very much influenced by folks like Dean Spade, who is also a legal scholar and also a trans studies scholar, and his book Normal Life, which really for me was eye-opening in terms of how trans people are specifically sort of targeted and surveilled by the law in various aspects, whether it is just something like being able to change the gender marker on your driver's license, whether it is questions of housing access, et cetera. So Dean Spade, I would say a group of very radical queer activists and thinkers, commonly known as the Against Equality Collective, has been very influential in some of their shorter collections and pieces that they have published. But there's also a lot of really foundational media studies work by folks like Herman Gray on visibility politics that really have drastically shaped my thinking in this book. And so I really, wrote this book to be in conversation with many folks and scholars that I admire from various fields. And I hope that by being in conversation, we can also really just build more scholarship that critically looks at issues around trans representation and how we can improve the lives for trans communities.
Well, this is not a question about books, but since I just watched it, I'm curious, did you have a chance to watch the Netflix documentary, Disclosure?
I have not, unfortunately.
Okay.
yes, I know. I had several people have already texted me. Were like, have you seen it yet? We got to talk. And so, no, unfortunately, I have not had a chance yet. But yes, it is high on my to-do list. Okay. And I'm definitely curious. But yeah, do you want to share briefly your impressions?
I think it was a very, very necessary film.
Mm-hmm.
I just watched it last night and I'm still thinking about it. And
yeah.
I went to film school, so that hit, I'm not going to spoil anything, but there's a section where they discussed D.W. Griffith that was like, we need this in the world right now.
Yeah.
But what are you working on now? What's your next project?
That is also a great question. I'm continuing to be really interested in this sort of question of visibility and the pros and cons of visibility. And so in a more recent article that I've been working on that has come out after the book, I've specifically turned towards art and artists to think about the ways in which they can challenge those narrow confines of visibility. So for example, I've been working on a piece about Castles, who is a gender non-conforming performance artist who has done some really fantastic in-your-face artwork for and about trans people. So one of their more recent installations, for example, was collecting 300 gallons of urine and putting it in a big giant plexiglass cube with an art installation around it to call attention to the Trump administration's, harassment and discrimination and targeting of trans communities. So I'm turning to analyzing some performance art to also, again, think about the ways in which performance art can maybe help us to, again, broaden the confines of visibility and to challenge some of those narrow, respectable images that we only get to see in mainstream media. So that's been one thing I've been working on. Another bigger project that is kind of ongoing is, as I mentioned earlier, this notion of trans athletes in sports, I think, has gotten a lot of attention more recently. Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education, for example, just sort of threatened Connecticut that they are not allowed to have trans athletes play in their collegiate leagues. Otherwise, they would pull funding, basically. And so I'm kind of turning towards the arena of sports to also, again, think about who is included in sports and who is not included. And why are particularly, again, trans women right now being very viciously targeted by various conservative groups to prevent them from actually participating in sports?
Oh, I definitely want to read all of that. All of it. Mia, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, thank you so much. It really was a pleasure. I'd love chatting with you. And I know there would be so many more things to say. But I very much enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for the very thoughtful and provocative questions. This was really a pleasure.
You. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to another episode of the New Books in Gender Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. I just spoke to Mia Fisher about her book, Terrorizing Gender, Transgender Visibility, and the Surveillance Practices of the U.S. Security State. It was published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2019. I'm Isabel Machado, and until next time.